Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the wonderful series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the Top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of the different ways you can listen. But now it's time for this interview with retired Professor of Electric Power Engineering, Pat Bodger, on the theme of energy and climate resilience. I've listened to the interview with Pat several times in the course of preparing the podcast, and I have to say I get something extra out of it every time. So please do take care to get what you can out of this wonderful interview and a very full interview with Pat Bodger. Enjoy. Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome Emeritus Professor of Electric Power Engineering, Pat Bodger, to this episode of Climate Matters. Pat's got a remarkable background in electrical power engineering, and if you're interested in fast decoupled load flow algorithms, then Pat's your man. But I'm talking with him because I'm particularly interested in his pioneering research that he got into many years ago on the relationship between energy and the economy. And Pat has some very revealing findings out of that. So, Pat, a very big welcome to Climate Matters, and thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Lindsay, and for the invitation to be on your list of contributors.
With your remarkably wide and interesting research background, my challenge is to keep the climate connections in mind, although I know that they're in your mind as well. As a start, and knowing that nothing is simple, could you please frame for listeners the broad relationships between energy, the climate crisis, and our quest to decarbonize pretty well everything?
The real world is physical. Every physical action on Earth requires energy to be expended. A consequence of this is that waste, things we can't use, is produced. These are discarded into the environment. A major waste product of energy use through combustion is CO2. This has been increasing the atmospheric CO2 levels to a point that there is human-made influence on our global climate. Consequences of this on human society and the natural environment are such that life of many, if not all, living species is threatened with permanent change and/or potential extinction. Our challenge is to modify our behaviour in such a way that this doesn't occur, or at least is acceptable.
That already throws in, I think, an idea that might challenge some people's thinking, and that is that that carbon dioxide from our vehicles and things is actually waste. And, you know, you talk about that sort of thing. It's a waste product, and of course it is. So moving on, I mentioned earlier your involvement with energy and the economy. The fundamental concept of net energy gain seems technical, but is in reality quite a simple concept. It also seems an invisible elephant in the room, not only for energy policy, but also for the economy. It would be great if you could give our wide-ranging audience a net energy gain 101 and outline why it's so crucial to our future.
Now, what we call an economy is the production and trading of material goods and services. Thus, the real economy is physical. Energy underpins all economic activity in human society. Nothing is done without energy. It is required to produce or perform any and every good or service. This energy is embodied in the production of goods and services. Hence, all activity within an economy can be measured in terms of energy. Where has all the energy that drives our economy come from? To be useful to society, the amount of energy we get from a primary resource needs to be greater than the amount of energy used in extracting that energy. There needs to be a net energy gain. There are a number of primary resources that we have used which have a net energy gain. Over the last 2 to 3 centuries, we've moved away from the use of sustainable energy energy resources such as wood, agriculture in the form of hay or horsepower, water, wind, and the sun, to non-renewable fossil fuels of coal, oil, and natural gas, and to some extent nuclear energy. In general, and hydro and nuclear are exceptions to this, we have gone from renewable resources that have a relatively low net energy gain to fossil fuels which have a much higher net energy gain. This has allowed our physical economy to expand faster and greater under fossil fuels than renewables. With our knowledge of the effects that increasing fossil fuel energy has on the environment through CO2 emissions and climate change, we're aiming to move away from fossil fuels and back to renewable ones. This means a lower net energy gain and less energy into the economy.
Well, I want to pick up on that last question a bit more, because a couple of things that stuck in my mind, what you just said was nothing is done without energy. And this means a lower net energy gain that we'll be working with renewables. So picking up on that, I'm going to ask you to delve into the risky space between energy and politics. And apologies that there are a plethora of document references in this little explanation. Councils around the country have recently consulted their communities on the 30-year future development strategies that are required under the National Policy Statement on Urban Design. In the Nelson-Tasman region, our main consultation document was supported by a substantial technical document, which, among other things, said it elected not to consider the National Policy Statement for Renewable Electricity Generation because it's not considered to have any particular relevance to this draft future development strategy. That's me quoting the last bit. This surprised me for two reasons. A, renewable electricity generation seemed to me to be one of the keys to a buoyant future that the future development strategy is meant to be planning for. And B, the future development strategy seems obliged to actually consider it. And I quote, it's meant to consider every other national policy statement. And in fact, the technical document quotes that too. Should I have been surprised at the supposed lack of relevance that the technical document saw for renewable energy?
In conventional economics, energy is considered a derived demand. It's just one of the many inputs to an activity and not necessarily seen to be the most important driving. But it's not. And so let me re-emphasize, energy underpins all economic activity in human society. It is required to produce or perform every good or service. To me, every planning strategy, long or short term, should consider the supply and utilization of energy and emissions. There should be no sector of our society that is exempt from that. This is what is known as energy and emission analysis, and it should be part of every development promoted. It's an accounting process. We can then make decisions informed by this knowledge. Until we do this, we will not correctly account for the environmental impacts of what we are proposing to do. Additionally, there is sufficient literature that suggests that before we can effect sufficient change, we will be limited by the availability and accessibility of materials to develop the infrastructure needed in a proposal to become sustainable through the use of a renewable energy. If so, then a lower energy future will occur.
Pat, that you're throwing in, just like they're second nature to you, concepts that are probably hit the general public between the eyes. Like you said, energy is normally considered derived demand from the economy, and yet it's the opposite way around. There should be no sector of our society that's exempt from this. And then, of course, you close by saying, if so, then a lower energy future will occur. Back to the question of net energy gain and what is known as EROI. I don't think we talked about that in those terms before, but EROI being the energy return on energy invested. And you touched on the criticality of net energy gain. And so we also live in an era when renewable energy generation is never far from the news, be it biofuels or hydrogen, wind power, or whatever. However, my understanding is that the net energy gain of almost all renewables is pretty awful and likely inadequate to sustain our societies in the form we currently know them. Please, can you elaborate on the adequacies or otherwise of renewables?
Moving away from fossil fuels to renewables will mean reducing energy in society. And let me illustrate this with respect to the electrical industry. Electrification as a technology has had the greatest influence on the quality of life in human society. However, globally, this is the single biggest sector that contributes to anthropomorphic or human climate-induced climate change. The majority of electricity is generated using fossil fuels, namely coal, oil, and natural gas, the burning of which releases greenhouse gases. We are aiming to become even more electrified, as this is seen as an efficient vector to transfer energy from natural resources to where we use it. Increasing electricity consumption requires increasing production. Increasing production requires increasing capital investment in energy terms in the energy industry that gives us electricity. With energy, any energy source and converting this to electricity, we can look at the actual emissions released. Generally, fossil fuels release a lot more greenhouse gas emissions than do renewables and nuclear, for the same amount of energy delivered to society for its use. Another measure that is useful in considering renewables and fossil fuels is the energy return on energy invested, EROEI. In general, the EROEI for fossil fuels is greater than that for renewables and nuclear, except for hydro, which is a limited resource, geothermal, which is also a limited resource, and perhaps wave power, which is not significantly commercial as yet. Thus, to get the same amount of delivered energy from renewables, other than hydro, as for fossil fuels, the infrastructure requires many times more energy to manufacture and operate. This means that the energy industry would need to become much larger than it already is to be sustainable. That energy needs to come from the renewable energy industry itself. This is at the expense of energy investment and other aspects of society. Hence, society becomes a less energetic one.
Thanks for that insight, Pat. And the idea that we're having to invest more and more energy in getting energy and that leaving us less for the other things that we like to do is a really important concept. One of the pleasures of having an expert like you on our show is the chance to invite you to say what you think is important. If you had just one key take-home message, what would it be, please, Pat?
I'll try and make it one. as individuals, we have choices which can be made. We can choose to think energy and emissions. Every action we do, everything that we buy represents energy and gives rise to emissions. The extent that we do this is dependent on our choices. So let me be a bit more specific and elaborate. If we don't do something, we don't use energy nor produce emission. It's a choice and a highly effective one. For instance, turning off appliances when they're not needed. If we do something, then we can aim to do it as energy efficiently as possible and to produce a minimum of emissions. We can drive smoothly. We can aim to substitute what we plan to do by something else which uses less energy and produces less emission. For example, biking to work rather than drive a vehicle. We can offset our emissions by doing something else that reduces them. Plant sustainable forests. This mindset is a way of thinking for life, thinking in terms of energy and emissions.
Now, I must say I was struck when you said that it's a choice and a highly effective one. In the same series, I recently interviewed Professor James Renwick, who's one of the climate change commissioners, and he said a very parallel thing. He said, this is a problem that's 100% in our control. You know, we're the cause of this problem, and we can be the solution for it too. And that echoes what you're saying. I'd like to shift now into the logistics of the energy transition, that is the transition away from fossil fuels and into renewables. A couple of years ago, Transpower brought out their Timori Eco Energy Futures document, exploring decarbonising our economy, and the logistics of meeting their projected electricity demand seemed to me daunting. Can you please outline for listeners the main challenges that you see for us achieving a decarbonised energy sector? And that, if you wouldn't mind taking the supply and distribution perspective, which I know is your professional and academic background, that would be great.
Decarbonisation means reducing the use of fossil fuels, increasing the use of renewable energy and carbon capture and storage. At present, the renewable sector infrastructure is being supported by the use of fossil fuels, e.g. the manufacture of wind turbines and solar panels. To be sustainable, renewables need to support itself as well as supply society's energy needs. The relative EROEIs of fossil fuels and renewables suggests that the energy cost for renewables needs to be much larger than it is for fossil fuels if it is to replace them. For an example, if the EROI for solar is 6, and that for coal is 30, and these are representative values, then for the same amount of output energy, the solar power plant's whole-of-life energy cost is 5 times that of the coal-fired power plant.
Yeah, that's a good illustration of the proportionality and one of the challenges we have to face moving from fossil-fueled energy into renewable systems. Thank you very much. And in a way, that has a bearing on my next question. Even though we all know we've got to stop using coal to generate electricity, it constantly surprises me how much coal we still burn at Huntly Power Station, even though we know it's totally wrong from a climate perspective. I've wondered if it's the challenge of meeting peak demands, or maybe a feeble government policy, or a quirk of the spot pricing market for wholesale electricity, or maybe something else. Please, can you enlighten listeners and me why we still burn so much coal for electricity generation and what we need to do to end it?
A fundamental technical characteristic of an electric power system is that there is no significant storage of electricity. We rely on the primary energy as the storage. Hence, electricity generated is what is used plus the losses in the delivery system. Our use of electricity is still increasing. Hence, if we don't have sufficient renewable electricity, we need to use fossil fuels to provide the shortfall. In the short term, we can only get off fossil fuels if we use less, as it takes time to develop new generation infrastructure. In the longer term, we still need to balance our use with what is available from renewable resources, and we're a long way off this. Pumped hydro storage is a technology aimed at doing this, but its net energy gain is negative. It is not a primary energy which can drive the economy.
Oh, more interesting thoughts there. Thanks, Pat. But it does tempt me to ask a follow-up question. You said something, and I'm paraphrasing, we can only get off fossil fuels quickly if we use less energy. And that suggests to me that there is a bit of a prioritisation issue. The problem seems to be framed by government and industry as we need all this energy, so we have to keep Huntly using coal. But if we reframe that as we have to stop using Huntly coal as soon as possible, so we need to cut down our energy use, we'd be looking at the problem in a very different way. Would you mind commenting on those priorities?
If it is recognised that climate change mitigation is the priority issue, then reducing carbon emissions is a fundamental response. If we stop using Huntly coal, in the short term, electricity usage becomes one of rationing as the supply is limited.
Yeah, so that puts it again in perspective, doesn't it? Possibly rationing electricity as one of our ways of decarbonising. And I would like to have time to explore that more, but I actually don't know that we've got that time. So I'll get into the next question. It's about climate change, as always, and pollution. You and I have chatted about the climate crisis over a few years now, And while a lot of public discussion focuses on concepts like the greenhouse effect or emissions targets or ocean acidification, I've heard you frame global warming quite bluntly and simply as a pollution problem. Please elaborate.
Pollution is putting something into the environment that has a harmful effect. All energy supply and use contributes directly to air pollution, water pollution, soil pollution, and solid waste production. One form of air pollution is CO2, a byproduct of combustion. It is a pollutant in that an excessive amount has led to undesirable changes in atmospheric conditions, what we know as anthropogenic climate change. How do we mitigate the effects of this pollution? This is essentially a more macroscopic rehash of the personal choices we can make that I alluded to at the end last time. What energy we use can be supplied as efficiently as possible. This requires innovative improvements in technology developments. We already do this well and readily adopt innovative ideas. One energy form can be substituted by another that is less polluting. This is the argument behind using natural gas to replace coal or oil, but also using renewables to replace any fossil fuel. We're doing this, albeit very slowly with the latter. We can increase the amount of greenhouse gases that are captured and stored. This can be used, can be by using technology and or natural methods. Again, we are doing this, but it takes a long time to achieve this, i.e. plants don't grow overnight. We can use less energy, and this reduces the amount of greenhouse gases produced. Conserving energy is 100% effective, as every kilowatt hour not used is a kilowatt hour not needed to be generated and emissions not generated. We are not doing this as well as we could, yet it is something we can have an immediate and lasting effect. And finally, we can try and adapt as anthropogenic climate change takes hold. We are doing this to some degree as well. All strategies are viable, and what we do will be a mix of these.
Yes, very interesting again. Look, it's a great shame to be reaching the end of our interviews. I could keep going quite a while, but we do have to close off. And I wouldn't like to close without respecting you as a specialist in this area and asking you if you have any issues that you'd like to see prioritized in any particular way or a key take-home message for any of our listeners. Over to you.
Thank you, Lindsay. I suppose we have choices we can make, and it's about how we perceive energy and emissions affecting the climate and the planet that we live in. We can choose to undertake a number of strategies. It's really up to us.
Well, I think that sums it up pretty well. Thanks, Pat. The question of personal choice, and I think we're all realizing that we've all got to change our ways, perhaps more than we think, but perhaps also we can still live really well, even if we're living in a different energy environment. Pat, we have to close off. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise and your wisdom on these things, and I look forward to maybe talking again another time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lindsay, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, isn't it such a privilege to be able to hold a conversation with someone like Pat and tap into his wonderful expertise and most unusual areas of insight? Now, I promise to give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify, Apple, and other main platforms, and can be linked from my firm's website, which is www.resilience, that is R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz, and there you'll be able to navigate to our podcast page, which has all the links to the podcast. It will also give you the full schedule of the podcasts and the radio series, as well as information on Fresh FM itself, their broadcasting frequencies, and to the podcasts of the radio shows, which are largely in condensed down to about half the length on the Resilience podcasts. I don't want to close without giving a big shout out to Kahu Sanson Burnett, who's my invaluable sound technician and podcast whiz. And of course, a big shout out to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts coming up on the series, and I hope we enjoy your company for them too, including next up on the theme Buildings, Urban Form and Transport. We have Sam Archer, who is the Director of Market Transformation at the New Zealand Green Building Council, and Professor Rafe Chapman from Victoria University of Wellington, who specialises in climate and urban policy. So this is Lindsay Wood signing off, and as always, kia kaha, stand strong for the climate.